And open it up. Start the broadcast. And
the broadcast is now starting. All attendees are in listen-only mode.
Well, Kathy, do you want to lead off at this point?
Oh, sure. Sure. Hello, everyone. Good afternoon. It's Kathy Fetke here, and Larry Arth is here as well. I think we got Ron Monabot here. So, hello, everyone from the U.S. We are really, really excited to share with you this information today that I know you've been waiting for a really long time. And I've been telling you, we cannot predict when we're going to get financing, but when we do, you're going to be the first to hear about it. So today we're going to be focusing on some financing that is new to the market, and it is available to you, Australians. So, and it's just a really unique program. So with that, I would like to bring Tim Herridge on to tell us what's going on out there in the lending world. So welcome, Tim.
Thank you, Kathy. I am. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Ah, well, thank you. Hope everyone can hear me well. It's, I guess, afternoon in Australia, yet it's about 9 o'clock at night here in Texas. So I'll try to keep it short and sweet. And if you have any questions, I'm guessing you can chat to the organizers and ask them some questions. So, like Kathy said, financing has long avoided those of us that have invested in real estate in the U.S. And over the last 9 months, I've been up to something a little special, and I want to tell you about it. So, just for starters, I'm here for your entertainment. This is my just standard disclaimer. You can probably read it better than I can read it to you. Bottom line is, don't do anything before you talk to someone smarter than me. So I spent about 5 years in the U.S. Marine Corps as an intelligence analyst. I was lucky enough to visit Darwin, Australia while I was active duty. That was a beautiful place. I hope to go back again. I'm a home investors franchisee, which in the U.S., this is the company that says we buy ugly houses. They've bought a little over 70,000 houses in the last 15 years. Since I've been with them in the last 12 years, I've bought, it's a little over 1,100 houses now myself. I'm the founder of a thing called the REI Expo, which is the largest trade show for real estate investors in the U.S. And I'm also a development agent for home investors, which means I have about 42 offices across the United States that report to me and that I help get started and kind of help move their careers along. But most recently, what we're here to talk about today, I'm a managing director at B2R Finance. B2R means buy to rent. So I'd always like to start off with this. Everyone says there's no inventory and this market won't last long and what is the right strategy? And at this point, if I had an interactive audience, I'd say, who bought all the houses? And everyone in the audience would say Blackstone, because that's the big hedge fund that bought all the houses. They bought about 46,000 houses in the last 2.5 years. But in reality, Invitation Homes, which is a Blackstone company, only owns about 45,000 houses now. All in all, if you take the top 20 companies that own houses, they have 150,000, 200,000 houses somewhere in there. The point is, it's minuscule with regards to the actual single family, 1-4 family rental market out there. So when you look at it, the big guys, so to speak, of the 14.5 million residential rental units out there, they own less than 2% of those. And so I always joke around, you know, there's plenty of inventory to go around. And if you're saying that the hedge funds bought them all, well, you know, you're not going to get any sympathy out of me, because I know it's just not true. So this is, what an appropriate slide for this audience. So last year, we started really looking at the debt available in this space in the U.S. And you take a country like Australia, where over 25% of all mortgages originated are actually backed by investment property. And then you go to the U.K., and 12 to 13% are backed by investment property. In the United States, it's an abysmal 6%. And actually, it's kind of funny. In the U.S., the better you get at being a landlord, we actually then say, no, you can't get financing anymore. Because with our conventional loans here, once you had really over 5, well, then you're actually about to become professional and less of a default risk. So we wouldn't, the Fannie and Freddie Mac, our conventional government-sponsored entities, wouldn't loan you money anymore. So the alternative financing options out there really were hard money lenders, which I know there's a lot of people on this call that have been fortunate enough to pay that interest bill before. But it's a necessary evil, because if you wanted unconventional financing, you had to pay unconventional rates. And then you had community regional banks, which are just not scalable. Unless you only buy in one city and you live in that city and you can go down and have coffee with the loan officer once a week or once a month, it's really just it's an impossible and unpredictable strategy. And then the government-sponsored entities, Fannie will let you have 10 properties, Freddie will let you have 4, but really it's like I always joke around, unless you're Jesus Christ and have $5 million in the bank, it's really, no one ever gets to 10. So what we did at B2R is we stopped and we backed up and said, okay, let's look at investment property and how to finance them and what makes sense. So we took a commercial loan philosophy, debt service coverage ratio, or net cash flow, and we said, okay, let's look at the net cash flow of the rentals, and is there a way to figure out what someone can borrow based off the cash flow of the property? So to understand DSCR, you have to really talk about understanding net cash flow. You have the gross potential rent, and let's just say that that's $1,000 on a house here in Dallas, Texas, minus the vacancy factor, say 8 to 10% of the gross rent over a two-year period you're actually going to lose in lost revenue because it's going to be vacant for that amount of time, minus maintenance expenses, another 8 to 10%. It gives you an effective gross income, minus your operating expenses, property tax, insurance, and property management. And then that gets you down to the net operating income. And then you back out capital expenditures, things like a roof, central heat and air, plumbing systems, major repairs that you just don't know when they're going to happen. But if you're going to own the house really longer than 3 to 4 years, it's going to happen. And it may not. On one house, you could probably own it for 10 years and never have a problem with it. You may get that lucky. Unfortunately for me, it would be like the first month I owned it that I'd have a problem. But we back out about $500 a year for capital expenditures, and that gets you down to the underwritten net cash flow. Now, once you're at the net cash flow, this is where the debt service coverage ratio comes into play. So basically, our debt service coverage ratio limit, or I guess floor, is 1.2, which means the net cash flow has to cover the principal and interest of the loan you're asking for 1.2 times. So the best example I can say is if you come to me and ask for a loan where the principal and interest is $10,000 a month. Say it's $1 million loan and it's a $10,000 a month payment. Well, that means that your net cash flow has to be $12,000 or 1.2 times the principal and interest. Because then when we look at that, we say, okay, after vacancy, after maintenance, after operating expenses, after capital expenditures, no matter what happens, there's really no reason that this investor with this business, because really a rental portfolio is a business, you have an asset value, you have a appreciation, and you have company net worth, and then you have an income stream, and it's like any business. You have business value and equity on the books, and then you have income. So, that's the way we underwrite our loans, and I always like to drive that point home because it's not on your debt to income, it's on the cash flow of the property. Now, 1.2 is our minimum debt service coverage ratio, and the way we look at it is if it's more of a risky deal, we may, or if it's a neighborhood, we look at it on a census tract level, which here in the U.S. is about the smallest level you can look at data. It's about 18 to 20 houses wide, and we look at it. We look at crime rate, we look at actual real vacancy rates, real maintenance rates, and real data for all the way down to that granular level. So when you look at these commercial loans, the problem is they don't really feel they don't feel like loans people are used to. But the advantages are really with us, there's no limit on the number of properties. We do have a minimum of 5 properties because we know that once you get to 5 properties, you're a much safer credit risk for us because now you have cash flow from 5 properties to pay the loan that I'm going to give you because I always joke around that we run the models on this business, and the business works best when people pay their loans, right? I mean, as long as they pay their loans, business works great. So you have to have five houses, but there's no minimum. And we've done portfolios with 300-plus houses. We're looking at one portfolio with nearly triple that amount of houses. So there really is no limit. With us, it's one blanket loan. So I always love the ideal behind being able to take 50 or 60 mortgage payments and combine them all into one monthly payment, one statement, one lender, one relationship to manage. And the difference, and then we loan the money to the corporate entity. So if you were a foreign national, you would actually have to set up a U.S. corporation, and that corporation would be my borrower. You would be the sponsor of the corporation. And again, we underwrite the net cash flow, not the individual's income or debt to income. After you've owned the property for 12 months, we really don't care if you're pulling cash out or not. We really, a lot of it goes off of the value of the home. If you've loaned it in less than a year, we have some what we call cost constraints. In year one, we won't let you pull out. If you're trying to refinance a house you've owned for less than a year, the maximum we'll let you pull out is 90% of what you have into the house. Because what we know is when you have to, if you've owned it for less than a year and you have to leave equity in the deal, then you're much less likely to default on the mortgage. We have non-recourse and recourse options available, but for foreign nationals, it's actually non-recourse is the only option. Right now, our interest rates are somewhere from the low fives to the mid sixes. It really just depends on the portfolio and the risk of the portfolio. And again, you have to have at least five units to qualify. I keep saying houses, and I got to retrain my brain because I come from a house buying mentality, but it's five units. So if you have an eight-unit apartment complex, yes, we can finance that. If you have a duplex and a triplex, yes, that counts as five units. If you have two houses and a 10-unit apartment building, yes, that counts as the five units. So it's really I was telling someone the other day trying to break it down. They just could not understand the units concept. Five leases. So basically you have to have five different people paying to live somewhere, and that constitutes five units. Our lending programs are 5 and 10 year fixed rates. We have, if you are a borrower that would like to borrow more than $3 million, then we'll do a 5 year floating rate. We go up to a 30 years amortization with a balloon, but I mean, you can take that all the way down. Actually, one of the most common loans that we're getting asked for is someone that has a free and clear portfolio where they've paid cash for a lot of houses, and they want a 10-year fixed rate on a 10-year amortization. That way they don't have to think about the balloon payment, and it really just zeroes out at the end of the 10 years. Loan-to-value on the standard products up to 75%. We do limit that a little bit more rigorously with foreign nationals. It typically caps out in the low 60 percentile area. Again, the DSCR is 1.2. We do offer non-recourse and recourse, but with foreign nationals, it's always recourse. I mean, non-recourse. There is prepayment. There are prepayment penalties. And you get to pick. I mean, the prepayment penalties, at the end of the day, this isn't cheap flipper money. So in the first 2 years, it goes off of a concept called yield maintenance, which would, so if you had a five-year loan and you paid it off in year one just because you decided to sell it, you're going to owe about, and say you had $500,000 loans in the pool, you're going to owe 4 years worth of interest, of the unpaid interest on that $100,000 loan you paid off, minus whatever the current U.S. Treasury rate is. So it's expensive, but again, it's expensive because it's not intended to be short-term money. And so the only way we can loan the money out at 5.5-6% is by having these prepayment penalties in there. But again, most people don't even have a problem with it because number one, they have no intention of selling, and they plan to pay on time. There is limited substitution allowed. So if you have a $100,000 house that you get a crazy good offer on that you want to take, then what you can do is you can actually bring another $100,000 house in and substitute it. What you can't do is bring in two $50,000 houses. It has to be like or better kind whenever you substitute. So let's see. A little bit of a summary. Commercial mortgage loans collateralized by residential rental properties. So yeah, a couple limitations on that. 1 to 4 family condos, townhomes, duplexes, triplexes, quadplexes, multifamily, mixed use commercial. So as long as at least 50% of the property, or 51% I should say, is residential rental property, and your family does not live there, and the property does not or has never had wheels. So mobile homes, manufactured homes are not eligible for our programs. At the end of the day, I need to know that my collateral cannot drive away. And then, again, non-recourse only for foreign nationals. Loan amounts, it says $500,000 to $50 million, but I mean, we're quoting a $300 million transaction right now. 10-year, 5-year fixed, and floating products. Again, we already covered that. No modular, manufactured, or mobile homes. Low 60s for foreign nationals on LTV. And we already talked about the cash flow test. So, I mean, really, Kathy, that's about all I have, unless you have some questions. You were pretty good at keeping me on, doubling my time the other day with questions.
Sorry, Tim, I had one question.
Anyone can ask a question.
Sorry, Tim, I did have one question. Did I hear you correctly? You were saying you're quoting between 5.5% and 6% interest?
That's correct, yeah. We have not quoted a single deal above 6.62% interest, and that was really a loan we didn't want to do.
And is the variation in the percentage just based on what the collateral is?
It's based on the collateral, the loan-to-value, and really the property locations. I mean, we look a lot at the risk factor. So if it's a higher crime rate or maybe a newer property or a newer borrower, someone that didn't have any track record, that's going to increase our risk. So we really price for that.
Now, also, typically Australians will have all of their properties in the U.S. in separate LLCs, and often those LLCs are owned by an LLC, perhaps in Wyoming. So in that situation, the loan would be to the Wyoming LLC, or does it have to be a C Corp?
No, it can be an LLC, and I mean, in anywhere. I mean, we always say Delaware LLCs, they seem to be easier, but yeah, I mean, it can be the Wyoming LLC. The only thing is that the properties in the loan have to be the only assets that the borrowing entity owns, because the way it works, in the unfortunate situation that a borrower defaulted, what we do is we actually take over the company, we don't individually foreclose on each property. So we're pretty positive that one will really never happen. That's our hopes. But so if you own, I don't know, another U.S. business in that same LLC, then you would have to actually either pull out the other entity. It just has to be the only thing owned by that entity has to be the properties in my loan.
Yeah, I understand that. And I think for most Australian investors, that would be the situation. I don't think anyone would have other assets other than their rental properties in the U.S., not for Australians typically, anyway. I haven't got any other questions coming up on my screen at the moment. Kathy, are you there? I think Kathy might have gone amongst the missing somewhere.
Well, maybe it's late in California.
I'm sure it is. I was interested in your initial comment about being an intelligence analyst in Darwin. We didn't think there was any intelligence to analyze in Darwin.
Well, we were just visiting there. There was a lot of beer to drink there, but I mean, So we were actually working with the Australian military in East Timor, Indonesia back in 1998. So
right.
It was a good time.
Tim, I'll ask a quick question on the loans there. You talked about 5 or 10 year fixed. Are they amortized 5 or 10 year, or are they amortized 20 or 30 year?
You can pick the amortization up to 30 years. A lot of people do like a 10-year fixed and then a 10-year amortization to zero out where there's no balloon. But people that do the 30-year amort with the 10-year term, they just they are accepting the risk of the balloon at 10 years.
Sure. Okay. Thank you.
I mean, ideally, we're going to be around to refinance that. And that's the business model, but there's no guarantees.
Right, right, exactly.
So if we wanted to progress this, we just send you an email. Is that the best course of action?
Yeah, shoot me an email, or just Kathy has all of my contact information, and I've actually got an account rep specifically dedicated to her and her clients to make sure that they're taken care of in the proper way, because we know that there's a lot of intermediaries and third-party communication, and we just like to make sure that people get, you know, what they need out of our company. Or they can just check out b2rfinance.com and fill out the form, and someone will contact.
Okay, is that the best way to start? Is it just fill out a form from the website?
Yeah, because what we do is we send a spreadsheet. I mean, because we don't collect an application fee, run credit, background, or anything until we have the addresses and rental amounts for the properties. Because at the end of the day, I mean, if we actually do a term sheet and a quote before we ever pull credit or dive into background, because at the end of the day, really and truly, the property cash flow is typically the number one limiter once we model it out.
Yep, I understand. What you're essentially doing in Australian terms is cross-securitizing. Is that a term you're familiar with?
We use cross-collateralization.
Yeah, same thing. So that's essentially what you're doing in this particular case. You're lumping it all together.
It's just everything's in one big pool, and you know, by doing that, it's it makes it pretty simple to analyze.
Yeah, and but it does make it difficult to get out of. If you wanted to sell a single property, as you mentioned, it can be a little bit tricky.
Yeah. I mean, that's where the substitution is going to come into play. Or, you know, the first 2 years it's kind of steep, but after that it's a declining point scale. So, you know, if you're on a 5-year, then in year three it's only a 3%, and then a 2%, then a 1%. If you're on a 10-year, then that third year, of course, would be 8%, which is pricey as well, but down towards the end of it, you get some pretty good flexibility.
Yeah. I don't have any questions, and I don't see any questions popping up on my screen.
Okay. Well.
So that might have been one of the shortest presentations. I'm sure that your contact details and website are on the screen, so I'm sure people won't have any difficulty contacting you if they're interested. And
it's pretty cut and dry. I mean, we make loans to landlords for rental property.
Yeah. Well, certainly it's certainly interesting from my point of view, and I'll make sure that a lot of other people get to hear about it, because interest rates of between 5.5% and 6.5% basically are sort of typical of the interest rates that we have here in Australia, only marginally higher. Our interest rates here now are around about 5%, but this is only marginally higher, and I'm sure that a lot of people would rather refinance in the US than carry their loans here in Australian dollars.
To that note, Tim, I'll ask one more question. Is there any geographic boundaries?
The property has to all be inside the 48 contiguous United States.
Okay, anywhere in the 48 works.
Anywhere in the 48.
That works. Awesome.
And it can literally be. I mean, we've had this where it's one in California, one in Utah, one in Mississippi, one in Missouri, one in Texas, one in North Carolina, and one in Florida. And the borrower is just kind of tested all corners of the U.S., and it all goes into one lung.
Yeah.
And so, go ahead,
Larry. You go.
I was going to say, what's the acquisition boundary? I mean, what? Obviously, it's hard to buy five properties and close all at the same time. So, what's your wiggle room as far as time is concerned on acquisition of the five?
Yeah, for us, it's kind of a niche market that we're in, right? I mean, for us, you either have to have all five units already, or you have to have probably three, and then if you're buying, say, two more from one seller, you can actually close on the purchase and the refi simultaneously and use the proceeds from the refi for your purchase on the other two units.
Perfect.
But we joke around and call that the Loch Ness Monster, but the key is it would have to be done from one seller, and the proceeds would be, and you'd have to have all five units the day of closing.
Gotcha.
Yep.
So it's good way to leverage if you have some existing properties to refi some out and maybe pick up one or two more to make your five or beyond.
Yeah, I mean, we've got one client right now that had eight free and clear, and they're literally going to be able to leverage eight. And I want to say it was 14 or 15. They're almost able to double up just by leveraging the eight existing.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Well, one of the advantages for Australians, if you take my case, for example, when I transferred my money to the U.S. To buy property over there, the exchange rate was between 103 and 106. If I can refinance that now in U.S. dollars, then I can bring back to Australia at roughly 92 or 93. So so I get an instant advantage in foreign exchange just on that alone.
So what you're saying is I can charge you more points?
Well, that's basically what I'm saying, yeah. I just had a question come up on my screen in relation to the classes of properties. We kind of tend to class properties in the U.S., what we call A, B, and C grade properties. I gather that your finance, you look at all the properties individually and assess them on their merits, so you're not overly concerned about where they are necessarily. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, at the end, the minimum appraised value that we'll finance is it's $50,000, but if 10 to 15% of the pool is below 50, but above 35,000, then we'll look at it on a case by case basis. The written minimum is a property must appraise for $50,000 in its current condition.
Okay. Now, on the transaction, is there any concept of what we call stamp duty or any on costs in order to establish the loan?
You mean at closing?
Yeah. Well, no. In order to put these kind of loan deals in place, are there any fees or charges? You know, either state or federal, or ones that you charge.
So fees we charge. There's a 1.5% origination fee, which is paid upon funding of the loan, and then there's limited doc prep and legal fee on a non-recourse deal. You're probably looking $500 a house or per unit, depending on. But then that changes if it's multifamily. Then you have title cost, which depending on the state you're in, can be anywhere from half a point to a point. It just depends. And so all in, it's typically 3 to 5% in closing costs, depending on the state.
Yep. Okay. That's all the questions I've got at this stage.
All right. Well, thank you for having me, and feel free to reach out to me.
Thank you very much, Tim.
All right. Well, tell Kathy I said bye wherever she is. I know there was another presentation right after me.
Yeah, that's you, Larry, but I'm just going to make me the organizer again.
Yep, thank you for your time.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. Um, and hopefully I'm just bear with me while I get those images up online.
My two slides is the second presentation. Is that it?
Yeah, I've just got to get them and make my screen. When ready, click it. So. No, we're getting there, I think. Can you see my screen?
Right now I'm just seeing the Global Mastermind cover letter, if you will.
Might take a few seconds to get through.
It's shooting 10,000 plus miles across the continent.
Show my screen. It's still not there?
No.
I love this technology.
You know, I can talk it. It's a very simple little. There we go.
You got it now.
Simple little slide presentation. I won't call it a presentation. Just kind of a little snapshots of infographics, and it kind of goes, you know, to what he was talking about. You know, single family homes is something that Global Mastermind's been talking about pretty much consistently. This first slide, it doesn't look impressive from a percentage standpoint, but really what it's talking about, it shows the tenants' demand rising. Based on there's just so many children living at home, adult children, as you can see here, basically up to age 34 that are living at home, and that's been rising, you know, from 2006 till currently the last 6-7 years. Again, rising 1% doesn't seem like a lot, but in the form of numbers, that's basically 1.2 million adult children living at home. Now, as the economy starts to improve, or as it continues to improve, I should say, these people are wanting to get out of their homes, you know, double up and diversify and get into homes. And so that's 1.2 million people right there in and of itself that's out there looking for rentals. Over and above the population growth, if you watch the U.S. Census clock, it's really quite interesting. It shows that the population is growing at the rate of a net one new person every 10 seconds. Well, for the information people, you do the math, how many seconds are in a day, in a month, and year, and so forth. That's just a huge amount of growth and demand for housing. Just kind of goes to reaffirm that there is a big need for housing, rental housing here in the country. And then if you flip to the next slide, it just kind of shows and validates what people are looking to rent. You're able to make that slide change. There we go. Again, the bar is not moving real fast, but you see a nice consistent growth year after year after year. This is a demand for single family rentals, which is pretty much everything we've been talking about. And now here at 213, we're actually 214 now, but as of last year, we're running 35%, which is better than a third of all rentals in the U.S. are single family homes. And you can see that need, or that desire, has been rising year after year, so it's very significant. Foreclosures and short sales over the last, you know, decade basically has obviously contributed to that. When people are forced out of a house, you know, they lost their jobs or whatever the case may be, and they may have been in a $500,000 house, last thing they want to do is move into an apartment building with their family. They want to get back into a single family home. They might not be able to afford a $500,000 house anymore, but they can certainly afford a renting of a $100,000, $200,000 house scenario. So that's really what's been driving the demand for single family housing, and that demand just continues to grow. That's pretty much it. Like I say, I just had the two slides. Won't call it no presentation, but definitely some good information to help validate that you guys are on the right track there.
Well, it's always good to know that the U.S. economy is improving from, not only from our own point of view, but Australia always benefits when the U.S. economy improves. In fact, the whole rest of the world does, I think.
Absolutely, without question.
Well, I don't have any more questions. And if nobody else wants to jump in, I think we've lost Kathy, so we might just end the session there.
happen.
Sounds good. Yeah, I'm not sure if there's a power outage over there in California or what, but that could happen.
Oh, maybe they just didn't pay their bills.
Maybe. Sounds good, guys.
Thanks, Larry. Thanks, Tim, if you're still on, and Kathy, and thanks, everybody, for listening in. We'll end it there. Thank you.
Thank you all. Bye.